Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Parsha Perspectives for today. It's great to be back. Baruch Hashem just landed today from Eretz Yisrael. And I have to tell you, it's very hard to leave. Every time you leave Israel, you leave a piece of yourself to come back to be whole again. But for me, the opportunity and the privilege to come back to learn together and to grow together, it's essentially the only excuse or reason to be able to leave. And so I'm honored and grateful that you're here this evening. Starting next week, we'll back to our regular scheduled slot and time, Tuesday mornings at 9:30. But glad that you're here together tonight. Our Parsha series is sponsored yet again this year by our dear friends Becky and Avi Katz. We're so incredibly grateful to them for their generosity in sponsoring our Shir Shabilu the Nishmas in memory of David Grossman, Becky's father, David Ben Menachem Manish. We have the privilege this week of reading and learning Parsha Shoftim, page 1024 in the Art Scroll Stone, Chumash. Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'chol b'chol sha'arecha. We are marching on in Moshe's monologue, Moshe's soliloquy, the last days, hours of his life, in which he's turning to the people as they are on the cusp of entering the land without him. And he's sending them in with a message. He's sending them in with a charge. He's reminding them, these are mistakes we've made, this is what's gone right, this is what you need to look out for, and this is your purpose and your mission when you enter that land. So he continues now, Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'chol b'chol sha'arecha, that we have an obligation and responsibility to place judges and officers in all of our cities that Hashem gives us. V'shoftu asa mishpat tzedek, and then those judges and those police will exact, they'll practice righteous judgment in all of those communities. And the Torah continues, Lo satem mishpat lo sakir panim, don't pervert just judgment, don't disrespect someone's presence. Lo sikach shochad, don't take a bribe. Ki ha-shochad ya'aver inecha chamim v'salev divrei tzadikim, because shochad, bribery, blinds the eyes of the wise and makes just words crooked. It means no one's immune. All are susceptible. And bribes take the form not only of money. We gave a series of shiurim in the past on issues of bribe, using protectia, speaking of Israel, trying to get ahead, using connections, not what you know, but who you know, and what are the ethics and what's the halacha around all those issues. Our Chazal, our rabbis tell us, the word shochad, bribery, is shahu, that he and you are chad, you're one. Shochad creates aligned interests even when there shouldn't be. An objective judge should not be aligned with a particular party, but when they receive a bribe that could be in the form of resources, money, or the bribe could be currying favor, or the bribe could be flattery, or the bribe can be a compliment. A bribe can be all kinds and all forms, and we're all vulnerable and susceptible when we issue judgment in our lives. And we have to be careful because it, ya'aver einecha chamim, it can blind even the wise. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, pursue justice with justice. So you'll live and possess the land that Hashem has given you. So the opening section of our parsha, which is really a continuation of the last week, the end of Parshas Re'eh, we had the laws of the Moedim, the holidays, the three festivals that we ascend to Yerushalayim. And in an atmosphere of celebration of Yontif, it can be pretty frivolous. You drink a lot of wine. Ein simcha ela basa v'yayin. So a lot of barbecue, a lot of karbanos, a lot of the sacrifices, the meats being consumed. And with a nice, delicious steak, a properly chilled red wine. And so the environment can be very social, very frivolous, somewhat inebriated, intoxicated. So it's specifically in contrast or continuing that theme that our parsha begins, Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'cha b'chol sha'arecha. Don't allow a frivolous atmosphere or environment to let you not be regulated, undisciplined, to act in a way which isn't just or isn't righteous. And that's the contrast or the continuation of these two sections. Rabbi Sacks, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, in the Sacks Chumash, quotes his teachings, and it says the following, "For Jews and not only Jews, the religious voice is above all a moral voice. Avram is chosen so that he'll instruct his children to do righteousness and justice. When Hashem tells Avram, you know why I love you? You know why you're my man? I'm paraphrasing. Do you know why I've chosen you? Do you know why I want you to be the leader and the father of all nations? Not because you have the longest amida, Shmona Esrei. Not because you're the most religious. Not that there's anything wrong with being so scrupulous and vigilant and having a long prayer. But he says, the reason I love you is because you command your children after you lasos mishpat, to do righteousness and justice. Yeshayahu begins his prophetic mission with the most powerful speech ever made against the idea you can serve God in the house of prayer while ignoring him in the marketplace. Yeshayahu HaNavi teaches us, and we know this is the reason of the Churban, the great destruction of the temple happened not because of religious neglect, but because of moral corruption. When we violate and when we forfeit, when we abdicate our responsibility towards morality and ethics in the marketplace, Micha, the prophet, sums up the religious quest in three imperatives: do justice, love goodness, and walk modestly with God. And here in the text of the covenant, Moshe tells the Jewish people, tzedek, tzedek tirdof, pursue justice. How? With justice. Writes Rabbi Sachs, no idea in the Hebrew Bible has been more influential than this, that society is founded on a moral covenant between its members, vested in an authority that transcends all earthly powers, and whose most famous symbol is the Ten Commandments engraved in stone. Law, as envisaged by the Torah, makes no distinction between rich and poor, powerful and powerless, homeborn or stranger. Equality before the law is the translation into human terms of equality before God. Time and again, the Torah insists that justice is not a human artifact. I don't know if you're watching or listening later, but we're in the middle of a monsoon in Boca Raton, so I don't know if the mic is picking it up, but if you hear that sound, it is the sound of a very captive audience who have nowhere to go. Baruch Hashem. Because it belongs to God, it must never be compromised by intimidation, bribery, or favoritism. It is an inalienable right and also an inescapable duty, something that must be pursued actively. One might suppose that the divinity of justice reduces our accountability for justice on earth. God exists, therefore the universe is just. We, however, are human, and God has empowered us to seek the justice that is human, not justice from the point of view of the universe and eternity, but the point of view of the fallible, frail, ephemeral, vulnerable beings we are. We live in a space and time cannot but see injustice. We cannot know the rewards of a life beyond the grave. Our pain is not made less by the belief that it is necessary for the good of the whole. Still less it is made bearable than it is justified as punishment for sin. So here Rabbi Sachs explains the significance of tzedek tzedek tirdof, of a society that is not intimidated, it is not held by a tyrannical leader, it is not impressed by power, but bears an awesome responsibility for morality and for justice and for virtue. Not virtue signaling, which is an epidemic of our generation, people who want to signal they're more virtuous or just than others. But here our rabbis say, why the redundancy? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Rabbi Sachs alludes to it, he doesn't spell it out, but our rabbis do explicitly. I've shared it many times before, it speaks to me very deeply. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Why does it say twice? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice, justice shall you pursue. First of all, why do you have to pursue it? When do you have to run after something? When it's running away. So sometimes justice and righteousness, they feel like they're inaccessible. They're difficult to achieve or to grab onto or to hold. Sometimes they're fleeting, they're fleeing, they're running away. So pursue, run after it. Don't be satisfied with anything less. Run after that justice. But why the redundancy? And there are many, many explanations that are offered. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. My brother-in-law's father is a federal judge in New York. He has over his bench this pasuk, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. And he's a man who stands for justice and includes Torah teachings in his, certainly in his perspective, in his responsibility as a judge. But why the redundancy? So Chazal say, tzedek, bitzedek tirdof. Pursue justice with justice. Sometimes people, in the pursuit of justice, they in fact cut corners. They're dishonest. They lack integrity. Because of some noble ends, they practice an ignoble means. And our rabbis understood the Torah to be teaching us, tzedek, bitzedek tirdof. Even if the ends are noble, it doesn't justify an ignoble means. No matter how righteous the goal, you cannot cut corners. You can't be dishonest. You can't lack integrity. You can't be corrupt. You can only pursue justice, specifically with a sense of justice. Tzedek, bitzedek tirdof. You have to run after it, and you have to pursue it. You have to pursue it together. People have It's very troubling and deeply painful. The New York Times today picked it up as a story. And maybe I'm getting into trouble on my first day back. But it's okay. If you get rid of me and I have to turn right around, I'm happy to go back. There were 80 self-described modern Orthodox rabbis who signed a public letter challenging Israel for its methodology and what it's doing and the civilian famine and hunger in Gaza. And it's bad enough it was issued or published altogether. Now it was picked up. And the authors of that letter are in the company of the Neturei Karta and others who are on a side of criticizing Israel in a public way. That doesn't mean Israel, the Jewish people, are beyond reproach. We make mistakes as a people and our country too. But how and where we communicate, when we have concerns, tzedek bit tzedek tirdof. We have to be exceedingly and extremely careful and measured and sure of where we communicate, how we communicate, to what effect we communicate, the unintended consequences of our communication, how just we are in what we're communicating, and not only virtue signaling or trying to position as being more moral or more concerned than others, but what messages the Torah here is telling us, the awesome responsibility of those who are in positions of leadership and who have a voice, how, where, when, to whom, why, with what confidence and facts we communicate it. The Torah is telling us to be extremely, exceedingly careful and cautious when it comes to this, when it comes to this area. And how we do it, how we do it. Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha. Parsha begins by telling us, judges and officers, we have to place lecha. Why doesn't it just say shoftim v'shotrim titein? You need judges and you need officers. Why lecha? Lecha means, what's the translation? What does the word lecha mean? You. You should have officers and you should have judges. But the pasuk could have easily have read without the word lecha. It's extra and the Torah doesn't waste words. It could have said, shoftim v'shotrim titein b'chol sha'aracha. Have judges, have police in all of your gates. Says the Kli Yakar, says the Holy Kli Yakar, shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha k'shot atzmecha t'chila. You know why? Because Gemara in Baba Metzia Daf Kuf Zayin teaches, k'shot atzmecha v'achakach v'shoftu asam l'kasha zulaso ki kol dayna d'mafke minei mamona b'dina lav dayanahu. That a person has to judge themselves before they judge others. First, make sure you have judges and police. You can regulate yourself. Make sure you look in the mirror. Who are you? How do you behave? How do you conduct yourself? Who are you? First. So therefore, shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha. First, install judges and police for you, and then you can turn to everybody else. K'shor atzmecha v'achaka k'shor achirim. It's brought down the Chavetz Chaim, based on this Kli Yakar. Chavetz Chaim, when the Panovich Rav, Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman Zatzal, came back from Radin, Radin was the hometown where the Chavetz Chaim, the great Rav Yisrael Meir Kagan, the author of the Mishnah Berurah, Shmir Salashon, so the Chavetz Chaim lived in Radin. When the Panovich Rav came back from Radin, he stopped in Telz. And there, the Telz of Rosh Hashiva, Rav Eliezer Gordon, asked him, "Nu, tell me something you saw. What did you see in the Chavetz Chaim? Tell me a story. Give me a little taste of the greatness of the great Chavetz Chaim." So he said, "I'll tell you, every day after davening, the Chavetz Chaim would give a little chizik to his yeshiva. He'd give Musar a message. He'd give values, a lesson for life." He said, one day he announced he wouldn't be speaking that day. Why? He said, because the previous day, Chavetz Chaim said about himself, "I can't give a message after davening today. I'm not in a position to offer a public comment, because yesterday I didn't learn the way I should have. And if I didn't learn myself the way I should have, who am I to stand before you giving you a message?" Why didn't he learn the day before the way he should have? Because the day before, he took delivery of his Mishnah Berurah. And the Chavetz Chaim sat and painstakingly went through every word of every page of every volume to ensure that whatever customers would buy his new sefer, there wasn't a misprint, there wasn't a page that was blank, there wasn't something that came out wrong, lest they buy something from him and he would violate a prohibition of not providing the product that was sold. He was painstakingly going through it. That's why he didn't learn the time that a standard he held himself. And because of that, he felt unqualified to get up and give a message that day to his yeshiva. So that's what the Panovitcher Rav told, that tells the Rosh Hashiva, that's what he saw from the Chavetz Chaim, and he thought of this Kli Yakar. Shovtim v'shotrim titein lecha. First, make sure you have judges, policemen, practice what you're preaching, live the life before you turn to others with criticism, with feedback, before you offer anything to anyone else. That's at least how the Chavetz Chaim understood and lived, being careful himself before he would talk to someone else. But I saw one other interpretation on this opening pasuk, then we'll move forward. And it's Parsha Perspectives for today. I think this is something happening right now in Washington, D.C. The Reb Leib Chassman, the Mashkiach of Chevron, said the following. Lo lechina muva mashojim mashoftim. If you have judges, why do you need policemen? The judges legislate. The judges legislate the law. So why do you need policemen? It's an obvious answer. Because without policemen, you'll have law, but no law enforcement. And if you don't have law enforcement, you could have all the law you want on the books, but you're going to have an enormous amount of crime. It's not enough you have judges who can arrive at the truth, who can legislate the law. What's the goal? What's the purpose? What do you accomplish and achieve with the law if it's sitting on a book collecting dust, but it's not being practiced in the streets? Lachain, therefore, the Torah teaches us shoftim, b'chaberes ha-Torah ha-shoftim im ha-shotrim yachad, ki be'em es-chadhein. Because really they go together, law and law enforcement. We don't defund police, we don't fight or resist law enforcement, but we believe we need law, proper law, truthful law, authentic law, binding law, and you need law enforcement. No matter how much a person in theory wants to obey the law, but there's a lot of temptation, and a lot of opportunity, and a lot of drive, and a lot of distraction. And if you didn't have the image of the law enforcement to help keep you on the straight and narrow, to keep the law, then the law would be something in theory and on the books, and that's why we need and we believe the Torah endorses in all communities and in all cities, you need law and you need law enforcement. And if that's true for cities and community, for society, then certainly it's also true in the great teaching we know of the Shlach Kadosh, that primarily the Torah here is talking to each and every one of us. And that's why it's Shoftim v'Shotrim Titein Lecha. Chol Sha'arecha, in all of your gates, have judges and law enforcement. What are the gates to the individual? A city has gates, it has entrances and exits and thoroughfares. What are the gates to the person? So the Shlach Kadosh, Shnei Luchos Abris, Bishaya Levi Horowitz, the Shlach is buried in Tveria. I was just in Tveria. He says the seven gates in a person's head, in a person's body, you have the nostrils, you have the ears, you have the mouth, you have the eyes. These are the gates of the person. What we see, what we say, what we hear, how we engage, how we encounter our senses through which we operate, navigate this world are the gates to the person. And they need law and they need law enforcement. And if you don't have law enforcement, you don't have law. Because if you're not regulated, if we don't have the capacity to self-regulate, to be disciplined, to follow through and practice what we preach, it's all lip service. It's all lip service. So we are what we do. Not what we say we'll do, not what we believe, not what we pledge and what we promise, but you are how you behave. That is who we are. So the real us is not what we pledge or promise. It's not the image we have of ourselves for ourselves. It is our capacity to regulate, to be disciplined, to have self-control, to practice what we preach, and to put into our lives everything we say. So this teaching, Shoftim v'Shotrim, Titein Lecha, it begins with us, as the Kli Yakar said, before we can impose it on others. It applies to society and nationally, but it also applies to us individually. And it requires the partnership and the balance of both the Shoftim and the Shotrim, law and law enforcement. Truth in our beliefs, our principles, the laws by which we live, but also the law enforcement, the capacity to enforce on ourselves, to hold ourselves to the standard of that law. That's what the Torah here is getting at. Then the Torah continues, next section, Losita Lecha Asher Pasal Chafala, verse 21. You shall not plant for yourself an idolatrous tree. Eitzam is Bach Hashem Lekech Asher Ta'asalach. You can't plant an idolatrous tree. You can't plant any tree near the altar of Hashem, your God, that you make for yourself. Losachim Lecha Matzeva Asher Sane Hashem Lekecha. Don't erect a pillar which Hashem, your God hates. Says the Tiferes Shmuel, Shmuel Berenbaum. Our first Tiferes Shmuel of the day. He quotes Rashi, Losita Lecha Asherah, don't plant an Asherah, an idolatrous tree, near the Mizbeach. Azharlan Utei Ilan Ulevona Bayis Baharabayis. You're not allowed to plant trees on the Temple Mount, where Harabayis, where the Beis HaMikdash will stand, you're not allowed to plant a tree. Wonders of Shmuel Berenbaum. Yesh la'ayin shederach ha'olamu kishabona benyan mefuar. We have a magnificent campus expansion going on. Baruch Hashem, we're so grateful to our incredible, generous donors. We're going to expand the impact, the influence, the teaching, the lessons, the light that we hope spreads forth from here. So we have an architect. And what else do we have to have? A landscape architect. Why do you need a landscape architect? Because if you build a beautiful building, if you build a beautiful home, but you don't have anything left for a landscape architect, it looks blah. Dreh. You pull up and it's eh. You want it really be beautiful. You want it to be striking. You need an architect and you need a landscape architect. So one would think HaKadosh Baruch Hu's home, you'd have some great uplighting, landscape lighting, magnificent landscaping. And here the Torah says the exact opposite. When it comes to Hashem's home, Hashem's house, Beis HaMikdash, Har HaBayis, Temple Mount, not only don't you plant a Asherah, not only don't plant an idolatrous tree, don't plant any tree. Tevachola Torah Asherah hu avodazar v'loslam ilan v'chitzat v'parish Rashi Asherah kol eitz. Here we're talking not only about an idolatrous tree, we're not only talking about some tree people bow down to, we're talking about any tree. V'yesh lomar says of Shmuel Berenbaum, you know why? Shabeis HaMikdash ba'atzmusu hu yafa nof misos kol ha'aretz. David HaMelech in Tehillim describes the Beis HaMikdash as magnificent, the most beautiful thing on earth. Hashem's design is the ultimate design. It lacks, it is missing nothing. If you add on, if you try to complement, if you put something more, then you're taking away. More sometimes is less. And if you add, you're actually subtracting. If you think it's lacking or missing, you want to add bushes or landscape or lighting, then you're suggesting that Hashem is imperfect, that Hashem is incomplete, that His vision, His home, is not the way it should be. And that's not us. That's not what we believe. We follow the strict instruction. We follow what Hashem tells us. And we're doing what He provides is perfect. And it doesn't need any help. It doesn't need any addition. Torah Hashem is Tamima. We say in Tehillim, Torah Hashem Tamima, the Torah of Hashem, Tamim means whole or complete or perfect the way it is. It doesn't need help. It doesn't need our addition. It doesn't need us to complement it. It's perfect the way it is. And that's why Hashem says, the design for our Abayis, that's mine. This house is perfect the way I'm giving it. And therefore, you don't need any other architect. You don't need a compliment. If you add anything, in fact, you're going to be taking away. Rabbi Soloveitchik also has a comment here. Rabbi Soloveitchik in his Chumash writes, Rabbi Kiva Eger in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch cites the view of Rav David Arama that the prohibition of not planting trees was extended by the rabbis to include even a synagogue courtyard. The Rambam in his enumeration of the mitzvahs in the introduction of Mishnah Torah equates the Kedusha of a Beis Knesses with that of a Beis HaMikdash. The sanctity of a shul, says the Rambam, is the same as the sanctity of the holy Beis HaMikdash. Seemingly then, Rambam would consider this to be a biblical prohibition, which is even more stringent than the opinion of David HaRama, which considers planting trees to be a rabbinic prohibition. On the other hand, the Netziv, Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in his response to Meshiv Davar, argues there is altogether no prohibition to plant a tree in the synagogue area. Indeed, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, Maizeh de Reb Chaim Brisker permitted planting trees in the courtyard of the great synagogue in Brisk, and entirely rejected the opinion of Rav David Arama. In truth, there is no connection between Rambam's words in the introduction and the view of Rav David Arama. The prohibition of planting trees in the Beis HaMikdash depends on there being sanctity, Kedushas Makom. With regard to the shul, the Rambam maintains the structure of sanctity, it is therefore forbidden to destroy it, but this does not prove that there is sanctity attached to the place, which would forbid planting trees there. And even if we were to maintain their sanctity attached to the place, in which case it would be forbidden, there's no reason to extend it to the courtyard, which certainly does not share the properties of the shul. So we follow that psak. We have landscaping planned. We have landscaping currently. We have landscaping planned in our expansion. And we follow that opinion of Chaim Brisker that that was true for the Beis HaMikdash, but is not true for a Mikdash Ma'at, for a shul, for a temple in miniature. The Gemara comments on the juxtaposition of this verse to the obligation of appointing judges. And Reish Lakish teaches, this appears in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Reish Lakish said, he who appoints an incompetent judge over the community is as though he had planted an Asherah in Israel. If you appoint an incompetent judge, it's like you planted an idolatrous tree. What does one thing have to do with the other? You see that by the juxtaposition at the beginning of our Pasha. First we talked about judges, we went right to the idolatrous tree. But what's the connection between those themes? So Reb Chaim Soloveitchik commented that an incompetent judge is compared specifically to an Asherah because idolatrous shrines are generally identifiable. The Asherah, however, appears as an ordinary tree. So if you have a house of idolatry, if there's an idol, you know it's an idol. You know it's a house of idolatry. But a tree that people bow down to just looks like a tree. It's not identifiable. Outwardly, it is beautiful and luxuriant, but its essence is rotten. So too is a judge who outwardly appears qualified, but inwardly is incompetent and rotten. One who judges righteously is given extraordinary authority to act in lieu of the divine judge. In reality, no human being is capable or has the right to decide the fate of another, for he never knows the absolute truth. A dayan is referred to in the Torah as, anyone know another name for a judge in the Torah? Elohim. In fact, when you're pronouncing the word, you have to know, is it referring to God? Then it's Elohim. If it's referring to judge, it's Elohim, because he is of necessarily granted a divine prerogative. Consequently, if a human judge is incompetent, he in effect usurps divine authority and desecrates it. This is akin to idolatry. Figuratively, he has planted an idolatrous shrine in the very place which is imbued with divine justice, near the altar of the Holy Temple. It means that a judge who's using judgment is endowed with a divine inspiration, and therefore is in the place of the altar. And if you're incompetent or unqualified or corrupt, it's like you've planted an Asherah tree next to the altar, because in the place of the judgment that you represent Hashem, you're corrupt or somehow incompetent or unqualified. Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Zayin. Moving right along, turning the page. Turning two pages. 1028. Kisavo elart Asher Hashem lekachanu sein lach v'yiresh tovi shavta ba. When you enter the land that God gives you and you inherit it and you live in it. The Amarta, and you say, Asim alai melech. Kechola goyim asher sivosai. You know what the people are going to say? We want a king. Everyone else has a king in the Middle East. We want a king. We want a ruler. We want to be like everybody else. Here the Torah formulates it as sort of predicting, prophetic. You're going to conquer and inherit the land. You're going to set up shop. And then you're going to say, we want a king. Who initiates it? The people, the Amarta, you're going to say, Som tasim alecha melech ashir chashon lekech abosa. God says, okay. God says, okay, you should surely set of yourself a king, whom Hashem your God shall choose. So here it's prescriptive, and yet, in Sefer Shmuel, when the Jewish people want to place a king, all of a sudden, it's a harsh reaction. Why do you want to be like everybody else? Why are you just trying to keep up? What's the criticism? How is that warranted or justified when here the Torah seems to a priori endorse it or predict it? Or give a license for it. So that's a question for another time. So Som tasim alecha melech. And here we have the Torah telling us the laws of a king. And they have to become mekerev achecha. A king can't come from someone who's a convert. It has to be somebody who descends from the Jewish people. Tasim alecha melech. Lo sucha laseis alecha ish nachri asher lo achichahu. You can't have a stranger. It has to be one of your own. The Sifri learns melech velo malka. When it comes to positions of authority, it's a king and not a queen. A man and not a woman, that's for another time. Rak, and now we have some caution. It's not because I'm afraid. I'll tackle it. I'm not afraid, but another time. Lo yarbe. I'm so tempted, but another time. Rak lo yarbe lo susim lo yashav esam Yisrael eleman harbo sus. Torah says, be careful. The king has to be very careful. Can't have too many horses. Today we'd say you shouldn't have too much horsepower, not too many cars, because it'll bring the people back to Egypt in order to acquire the horses. That's where you got cars. You're not allowed to go back to Egypt. Can't have too many wives, even though polygamy was permissible at the time. For the king, be careful, not too many. Because if he has too many wives, he'll turn astray. Can't have too much gold and silver, shouldn't have too much money. When he sits on his throne, and he writes the Torah, Al Sefer Milifnei HaKohanim Alaviim. He writes for himself two copies of the Torah in a book from before the Kohanim and Leviim. And it should be with him. He has to have this Torah with him all the days of his life, learn regularly. To fear Hashem, to have awe of Hashem, to observe his Torah and all of his laws. Because the king, Levilti Rum Levavo, a king is very vulnerable to growing haughty and arrogant. And then he can veer from the mitzvah right or left. Be careful, take this caution, have these boundaries, and then you'll be able to sit on your throne for a long time. Writes Rabbi Sacks, very interestingly here, about the king. Can't have too much money. Select a monarch. Yeah. Is having a good king a good thing or a bad thing from a Jewish perspective? The question turns out to be almost unanswerable. Rabbi Sacks gets into it. But in any case, he shouldn't have too much gold, silver, or gold. Unique commands are given to the king. He must not accumulate horses so as not to establish trading links with Egypt. He should not have too many wives, lest his heart be led astray. He should not accumulate wealth. These were all standing temptations to a king. It was these three prohibitions that Shlomo, the wisest of men, broke, marking the beginning of the long, slow slide into corruption that marked much of the history of the monarchy in ancient Israel. It led, after his death, to the division of the kingdom. But these were symptoms, not the cause. The cause was the feeling on the part of the king that since he's above the people, he's above the law. As the rabbi said, Gemara in Sanhedrin Chaf Aleph, Shlomo justified his breach of these prohibitions by saying, the only reason a king may not accumulate wives is to lead his heart astray. So I'll marry many wives and not be led astray. Since the only reason not to have many horses is not to establish links with Egypt, I'll have many horses, but I won't do business with Egypt. In both cases, he fell into the trap of which the Torah had warned. Shlomo's wives led him astray. His horses were imported from Egypt. The arrogance of power is its downfall. Hence the Torah's insistence on humility, not as merely a good thing to have, but as essential to the role. And then he has a Torah that he reads from all the days of his life. Writes Rabbi Sacks here. We see that the king is commanded to study constantly. Later in the book that bears his name, Yehoshua, Moshe's successor, is commanded in the very same terms. Leaders learn. True, they have advisors, elders, counselors, an inner court of sages, and literati. Literati? I just got off a plane. For those who don't know what that word means, what is that word? Literati. Literai. What does that word mean? We're trying to learn. Okay. Well read. Apparently something I am not. True, they have advisors, elders, counselors, and inner court of sages, and that other word. In addition, biblical kings had prophets. Shmuel to Shaul, Nasan to David, Yeshayahu to Chizkiyahu, and so on, to bring them on the word of Hashem. But those on whom the destiny of the nation turns may not delegate the task of thinking, reading, studying, and remembering. They are not entitled to say, I have affairs of state to worry about. I have no time for books. Leaders must be scholars, b'nei Torah, children of the book, if they are to direct and lead the people of the book. It's a very powerful image Rabbi Sacks is painting. A leader, no matter how busy, no matter the burden they bear, no matter the people they carry, can't claim they have no time. They have the greatest responsibility. Leaders learn. They have to be scholars. They have to be b'nei Torah. They have to read their briefing books. And they have to read other books. They have to have libraries. They have to be curious and inquisitive. They have to study and learn. They have to challenge themselves. The two greatest kings of early Israel, David and Shlomo, were both authors. David of Tehillim, Shlomo of Shir Shirim, and Mishlei, and Kohelas. What separates the statesman from the mere politician are reading and writing. The key biblical word associated with kings is chachma, wisdom. We should note that chachma means something slightly different than from Torah, which is more commonly associated with priests and prophets than kings. Chachma includes worldly wisdom, which is human and universal, rather than a special heritage of Jews and Judaism. Broadly speaking, in contemporary terms, chachma refers to the sciences and humanities, to whatever allows us to see the universe as the work of Hashem, and the human person as the image of Hashem. Torah is the specific moral and spiritual heritage. Leaders take time to familiarize themselves with the world of ideas. Only thus do they gain the perspective to be able to see farther and clearer than others. To be a Jewish leader means spending time studying both Torah and Chachmah. Chachmah to understand the world as it is, Torah to understand the world as it ought to be. Leaders learn. They don't read tweets, they read books. Leaders learn and challenge their mind and have libraries and have ideas and think broadly so that they can lead properly. And that's something hopefully that we're not getting lost. It's something we should demand of our leaders. It's so something that those in positions of leadership have to practice. Torah here is telling us, with the king as the ultimate paradigm, that leaders learn. Leaders have to regularly engage in learning. Why? Because if not, levilti rum levavo me'achav. Torah cautions us, because it's very easy to feel superior, to swell with arrogance. Consistent with the fundamental Judaic idea that leadership is service, not dominion or power or status or superiority, the king is commanded to be humble. He must constantly read the Torah so he may learn to revere the Lord as Hashem. It's not so easy to be humble when everyone is bowing down before you, and when you have the power of life and death over your subjects. If a king whom all are bound to honor is commanded to be humble, how much more so the rest of us? And here Rabbi Sacks contrasts all of the cultures and peoples. The king makes statues to himself. The king is power. The king is honor. The king is glory. The king is a name. In the Jewish people, the king is a person of service. He serves the people, not the other way around. Moshe, the greatest leader the Jewish people ever had, was very humble, more so than any other man on earth. Was it that he was great because he was humble, or humble because he was great? Either way, as Rabbi Yochanan said of Hashem himself, wherever you find his greatness, there you find his humility. This is a clear example of how spirituality makes a difference to the way we act, feel, and think. Humility means living by the light of that which is greater than me. When God is at the center of our lives, we open ourselves up to the glory of creation and the beauty of other people. The smaller the self, the wider the radius of our world. And therefore the king, who could easily swell with arrogance or power, has a special mitzvah to maintain his humility and to practice even greater humility than others. Shmuel Berenbaum, the Tefer Shmuel, also has a comment here on the prohibition, lo yarbe lo nashim, can't have too many wives, can't be led astray, and too much money, gold or silver. Tzarch iyan, ariboy nashim katzva Torah tam. When it came to not having too many wives, the Torah tells us why you'll be led astray. When it told us not to have too many horses, the Torah gave us a reason. Why? Where do they trade horses?
Egypt,
and we're not meant to go back there ever again. But when it came to the prohibition, mekesev ezov lo yar belo ma'od, don't have too much gold and silver, it doesn't give us a reason. So the first two, there's a reason provided. And here the third, there's only a prohibition, but there's no reason provided. And the question is, why not? V'yesh lomar, says of Shmuel Berenbaum, v'yesh lomar, de'ekar asiba shamisha rotz l'harbas lo kesev ezov ma'od, hu g'day li'os batuach aleihem. What's the main reason to try to accumulate and amass as much money as possible? Having finances gives you financial security. Why do people want money? Financial security. They think if they have money, they have security. K'masha kasav, habotchem achelom avruv ashram yisalalu. B'mesha rotza akesav bavur atzmo, k'masha kasav lo yar belo ma'od. When it comes to money, it's obvious. We know why a person wants it. They're seeking security that they'll never find in the money. But when it comes to, they don't person has many horses, it's not because they think there's security in their horses. Many wives, not because they think there's security in their wives. So the Torah had to give you a reason for those two. But the money, everyone knows the reason, because it's a natural urge we all have, which is for the financial security. Listen carefully. Says Rav Shmuel Berenbaum. So a person who exerts extreme effort or initiative to earn money, who asuk biyom uvalayla, works night and day to get it, umashkia kokochosav laharchiv parnasaso kede laharbas laatzma kesev ezav, and exerts excessive effort to earn more beyond what they need to have, to survive, even to thrive, but still insatiably want more and more and more. Bezehu osa kesev shelo laavoda zara. He's turning the money into idolatry. Because if you think your security will come by having more money, what are you worshiping? Money, not Hashem. Who provides security and safety? Who takes care? Hashem. And if you think that money is the answer and the solution to every problem, and if only you have more or the most of it, then you have everything, then you are abandoning Hashem to worship the money. Shaba livtoch ba'kesef shelo, shaba yuchal lamali kol mishalas libo. You think the money can answer all your needs, all your questions, all your problems. And then you're going to take away your faith in Hashem if you put your faith in your financial security, not realizing that all security comes only from Hashem. A person has to know, whatever security we have comes from, only from Hashem. I said recently, it's not my quote, I forgot who authored it, that sadly there are some people who are so poor that all they have is money. There are people so poor all they have is money. And money can't buy you a cure from an illness. Money can't buy you happiness in a broken relationship. Money can't buy you qualities or quality of life that you're missing. Nebuch, there are people who are so poor that all they have is money. And so yes, there's nothing wrong with earning it, having ambition for it, enjoying it, being able to give it away. There's nothing wrong with it. But we don't worship it, we don't pursue it, we don't see our security as tied to or connected with it. And we're cautioned, like the king, to not express or exert excessive effort in pursuing it. Because if we do, we're worshiping it instead of Hashem. Rak birchas Hashem hi tashir. V'adam tzarech listak al hakesef kama shtar shel kesef she'elod misachakim ba. We have to look at cash like play money. All the money in the world won't solve a problem if Hashem doesn't want it to be solved. And without any money in the world, Hashem can help you avoid problems if He wants. It all comes from Him. The more we're aligned and calibrated and understand and living, because shoftim v'shotrim, we can't just know that up here, the shoftim, we can't just have that judgment in our head, shotrim, we have to police ourselves. We have to enforce it on ourselves to live a life with that perspective and with those priorities. And then Rav Shmuel Berenbaum continues. When he sits on his throne, he has to write this Torah. Kasha, lama yesh siva miyuchal al melech v'kara bo kol yimechayv. Why does he have to read it all the time? We all have to read it all the time. There's a mitzvah v'gisa b'yom v'layla. There's a mitzvah Torah obligation to learn Torah day and night. So once we already have the obligation to learn Torah day and night, what's extra, additional? Why specifically does the king have an extra command? What's extra here for the king? All day and night we have to be occupied and preoccupied with the pursuit and study of Torah. Tells us that when are we obligated to learn Torah? We once did a series of shiurim on the halachic definition of the obligation of learning Torah. What's the shiur? What's the measure? How do I know when I fulfilled the mitzvah? What are the criteria, the definition? Matzah, I have to eat a kazayis to fulfill the mitzvah. Shofar, I have to blow certain sounds. My esrog has to be a certain size. When there's a mitzvah, I have criteria to know I fulfilled the mitzvah. What are the criteria, the parameters, what's the shear of the mitzvah to learn Torah. If I learn 5 minutes, 50 minutes, an hour, a page, a chapter, a book, how do I define fulfilling my mitzvah every day of learning Torah? So there are many answers to that. We spent a long time, we had a series on that topic. But essentially, most define it as there are justifiable things that take up my time. If I'm not doing any of them, I have to be learning Torah. I have to earn a living, I have to take care of my health, I have to sleep, I have to eat, I need time for recreation, I need to spend meaningful time with people in my life. So all those are justifiable times, and during those, it's not that in those moments I'm not learning Torah, it's in those moments I'm exempt from an obligation. When does the obligation fall? When I'm not doing something meaningful, valuable, something that I can justify with my time. So one of those things is v'asavta diganecha. You gotta work, gotta earn a livelihood. In kemachin Torah, if you don't pay the bills, you can't study Torah. So the truth is that the everyman, the average person, has that defense. However, when it comes to the king, he's an exception. And why is the king an exception? That the king has to be exceedingly careful and cautious. Kol yimei chayev, v'kara bo kol yimei chayev. He has to read the Torah every day of his life. He has to go overboard because the king, again we said, can be so easily become corrupt. The king can become compromised. The king can become arrogant and feel superior. And the great anchor that when the winds are blowing hard and they're trying to knock us off course, the anchor that holds us true is the study of Torah. So those who are in positions of power or leadership, who are most vulnerable, who have the greatest danger for being distracted, they're the ones who even more so have to learn Torah on a regular basis, says Rav Shmuel Barenbaum. Torah is the anchor. Torah is the compass that calibrates our life and gives us its direction. The king who's responsible for all the people, the king who so easily can become arrogant and think he's above the law, has to spend extra time studying the law. The more that you're in danger of thinking you're above the law, because power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the king who can absolutely bring life and death has a special obligation to learn even more so. Okay, we saw Rabbi Sachs as well. Moving along. Perkei Zayin Pasuk Chaf. We saw this king has to avoid being arrogant. Rom Levavo. Levilti Sur Min HaMitzvah Yamin Yismol. We don't want him to veer from the mitzvah either right or left. And I'll just share with you because I found it cute and upcomingly relevant. He shouldn't veer right or left. What would make him veer right or left? Why right or left? So the Gemara in Baba Basra tells us, HaRotza Sheyachkim Yadrim, Sheyashir Yatzpin. The Beis Medrash of Boker Eton Synagogue prints a Torah journal called Yadrim. Volume 6 of Yadrim is coming out. It's going to the printer soon. So why did it get the name Yadrim? Because the Gemara in Baba Basra tells us, if you want to grow wise, face the south. If you want to grow rich, face the north. Why the south and the north? Because in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, the menorah was where? On the south. If you want to grow wise, face the menorah, the south. And the Shulchan, the table, was on the north. And the Torah, the table stands for material wealth, whereas the menorah stands for the light of Torah. So if you want to grow wise, face the light of Torah, face the south, face the menorah. If you want to grow rich, face the table, material, sustenance, and growth. I always love to quote. They say that's why the rabbi sits on the left side of the Aron, and the president sits on the right side. Because the Torah, the Gemara here is giving an instruction where to face. We face east, towards Yerushalayim, but the rabbi who wants to harotza lahachkim, yadrim. So if you're to the left of the Aron, you're facing southeast, because the rabbi wants greater wisdom. The shul president has got to make sure we stay on budget, sits on the other side of the Aron, because he's facing northeast. So Harotze Sheyashir Yatzpin. He has to make sure the budget. So he sits to be able to face the Aron. He's facing northeast. In any case, so the Ololus Ephraim writes, Hisiroso HaTorah Shelo Yischavim Basiyas Mitzvah Lasu Yamin Yismol Kedi Lazakos B'chochma B'osher El Yasa Kol Hashem Shemayim. The Torah says that the king has to be careful. Don't turn right or left. It means don't turn north or south. Don't pursue either wealth or wisdom do what Hashem wants, l'shem shamayim. So the reference to Yamin Ismol, a reference to Yadrim or Yatspin, north or south, and I thought that was worth quoting because our Torah journal, Yadrim, is going to the printer soon enough. And you don't seem nearly as excited about that as I am. Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Yud Gimel, page 1032. Here the Torah continues about prophecy and warns us not to pursue false prophets. Don't read your horoscope. Don't go to the Psychic Friends Network. Don't follow any silly superstition. Don't wear a red bendel, a red string around your wrist. It's not going to do anything for you. In fact, the Tosefta in Brachos calls it Darche Amori. It's a form of idolatry or silly superstition, as we have here. So in this context, Torah tells us, Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Tamim Tiyah Im Hashem Elokecha. Don't read your horoscope. Don't go to psychics. Don't give in to silly superstition. We left all that behind when we left Egypt. Mitzrayim, Egypt was a place of superstition and silliness. We don't believe in that. We believe only in Hashem. We don't believe in silly superstition. A cracked mirror and a black cat, and if you walk over someone, or if you wear a red string around your wrist, or if you believe any of this Narishkeit silliness superstition, we abandon all that. Hashem rescued us from all that. He took us out of the capital of that, Egypt. And he took us to an enlightened place where we know that there's a Hashem who runs the world. And he's the only one we need to be worried about. And that's what the Torah cautions us. Tamim tiyeh Hashem Elokecha. Tamim. What does the word tamim mean? Tamim. Be complete or be whole. But what does it mean to be whole or complete? So Rashi says, Hishalachima b'tmimus v'tetzap elo, v'lo sachkor achar asidos, elakom mashayavu alecha kabel b'tmimus. Don't try to predict the future. Don't go to a psychic. Don't do one of those weird Ouija boards. Don't open a book and see what page it turns out to and it's going to tell you what's going to happen. We don't believe in any of that silliness, says Rashi. Lo sachkor achar hasidos. Don't try to figure out the future. Whatever happens to you, accept and receive. Receive, live with innocent faith. Accept whatever happens without trying to figure out the future. Avoid superstition, fortune tellers, psychics. Leave the future in Hashem's hands and know you are where you're meant to be. Embrace your place. Let go. Let God. Don't worry about all these other things. So Shlomo Volbe, the great Mashgiach in his Ma'amar Yimei Ratzon, understands this command differently. He says people get focused and anxious about the future. They wonder and they worry. Their imagination runs wild with unlimited possibilities, opportunities and challenges about what the future might bring. What's going to happen? What's going to be? What if I get sick? What if we grow old? What if this works out? What if it doesn't work out? Where will we be? What's going to be? Says the Torah, relax. Take a deep breath. Tamim tiyeh. Don't fear the future. Don't get worried about what's not yet here. Live life in the present with confidence and with conviction and faith that Hashem is in charge, that Hashem has a plan. Do everything you're meant to do. Do everything that we can. Take all the initiative that's in your hands and then let go and let God. That's the Torah instruction. That's what the Pasuk's telling us. Tamim tiyeh im Hashem Elokecha. Don't worry about the future. Don't worry about things you can't impact or change. Don't try to predict what's not yet here. Have faith that if you live in the present, if you're mindful and you do all you're meant to do in the here and now, that Hashem will take care of the rest. Let go and let God. The past and future have value in how they shape and contribute to the present. But don't forfeit the present because we're concerned about the future or because you're lost in the past. The countdown to Rosh Hashanah has begun. We're now in the month of Elul. We usually think of Yom HaDin, Rosh Hashanah, as being judged. What do we get judged for? Were you nice or naughty? Were you good or bad? Hashem is going to open up the past year and is going to see how we behaved. We think it's all about the past and accountability and the future and our promise and pledge for how much better we'll be in it, but we're wrong. We're wrong. I'll never forget years ago when I first came across this chazal and it changed my entire understanding of these days. Gemara Rosh Hashanah Tezvav tells us, Tezayin, Ein Donenes Ha'adam Elofi Ma'asav Shel Oso Sha'a. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we are judged not for the past and not for the future, but only for the present. If you think about it for a moment, how could you be judged for the past? You can't change it. You can't go back there. can't amend it, you can't edit it. How can you be judged for a future? It's not yet here. The only dimension we live in, the only dimension we have control over, the only dimension we make choices in is the present. And therefore, Ein Dan La Adam Elafi Masav Shel Oso Sha'a, Hashem judges us only for that moment. So you'll say, I'm off the hook. I spent a whole year looking at the wrong thing, saying the wrong thing, going the wrong place, being dishonest, cheating, being miserable, getting angry, being impatient, being corrupt, and I'm off the hook? No, you're not off the hook. If the past is shaping your present, you're still responsible for it. But if you've left the past in the past, and in the present, you've redefined yourself, in the present, you're a new person, then the past, you're not accountable for. Tamim tiyeh, don't try to figure out the future and don't live in the past. Make the most of every moment by putting your faith and confidence in Hashem and live in Hashem. The Rambam teaches in Shmona Prakim, I wish we had time, I'd read to you inside what the Rambam writes. Ha'adam ha'shalem, tzarech lo she'yizkor midos of tamim. What does it mean to be an Adam ha'shalem? What does it mean to be the complete person? If you're living in the world of Shiduchim, you hear someone's described, he's the complete package. She's the complete package. What does it mean they're complete? It means they're missing a lot if they're described that way. But what does it mean they're the complete package? So the Rambam says, you know what a complete package is? Ha'adam ha'shalem, yizkor midos of tamid. The complete person, I'm reading the translation, must always be mindful of his character traits, consider his actions, assess his soul's qualities each day. Anything he sees within his soul tending towards any extremes, be quick with the remedy and not allow the bad quality to be reinforced by repeating the wrongful act. Also, he places before his eyes his deficient character traits and always tries to cure them. The Rambam teaches the Adam HaShalom, the whole person is the person who lives at all times with self-awareness, assessing his conduct, identifying strengths and weaknesses. The whole person is not a perfect person. The whole person is the mindful person, the person who's in the present, the person who's quick to recalibrate, to pivot, to make changes. Unklus translates the word tamim in our pasuk as shalim, whole. Revolba writes, the command of tamim tiyem Hashem lokecha requires following the Rambam's prescription. What essentially the Torah is telling us, tamim tiyeh, is be an Adam HaShalem. Constantly introspect, evaluate, live mindfully and purposefully, carefully determine who we are, who we want to be, and then be that best version of yourself. Tamim tiyeh doesn't mean be perfect, but it means be perfectly mindful. It means be present. Too many people are living life, they're on autopilot. They're mindlessly coasting through life. They're repeating the same day over and over and calling it a life. Tamim tiyeh means be present, means be mindful, be purposeful, evaluate. Many people go through life mindlessly. They go through their day doing what they do, but without thinking about it, even for a moment. An Adam HaShalem, being Shalem, is not about the quest to be perfect. It's not possible. And in fact, working towards it will set you backwards, not forwards. Being an Adam HaShalem means to be a person constantly thinking and reassessing and growing and challenging. It means having a growth mindset, not a fixed mindset. It means to be an Adam HaShalem, be a whole person by being present in everything that we do. We have time for one more. At the end of the parasha, we have the story of the Egla Arufa. A corpse is found between cities. We don't know where it belongs. And we don't know who the murderer was. So there's a whole formula the Torah tells us that you send out the elders, that shines a light, all the news cameras come and do coverage. Maybe that will help us solve the crime and the murderer. But the elders come, and there's a ritual that they perform, and they concluded, Pasuk Zion, V'anu v'amru yadeinu lo shavcha lo shavchu es adam hazeh v'einenu lo ra'u. The elders of the city, they say, our hands have not spilled this blood, and our eyes didn't see. Kaper la'amcha Yisrael, atone for and forgive your people. And Rashi here says, V'chiyasa alev shezikne beizden shavchi damimim. Supreme Court's going to come to this little shtetl, this little town, they're going to find this corpse, and they're going to say, wasn't us! We're not the murderers, we didn't do it, we didn't see who did it, we're good. What, as if we thought it was them? As if we're about to accuse them? That they have to say it wasn't us? Why are they saying that? Habir b'zek shodam argesh, says Rav Shmuel Berenbaum, shu nechshav tzrichino, so yesh lekoch lishmor es atzma derech v'lamod luchum kenegi mishakam kenegdo. When a person feels seen, When a person feels seen, and they feel relevant, and they feel they matter, and they feel consequential, then that gives them the strength and the courage and the confidence to face and persevere whatever comes their way. But when a person feels invisible and inconsequential, that they don't matter, and that they go through life unseen, then they're depleted of any energy. They have nothing inside to be able to fight, to be able to navigate. They have no resiliency. What happened here, this corpse? The Gemara tells us this individual left the city, Bali Levi, and nobody escorted them out. Nobody gave them some tzed al derech. Nobody said, here's some food for the way. Nobody said, let me walk you out. Nobody said, let me send you and say goodbye. Nobody said, do you need any food to take with you? What made the person vulnerable to be attacked? How did they end up a corpse, murdered, nameless? Because nobody bothered to help them feel seen. And that's why, indeed, the elders, a community whose leaders aren't careful to make sure that everyone feels seen, the blood of those corpses, that corpse is on their hands. This is a very powerful lesson, a very powerful message, and one we could and should expand on another time, but particularly relevant for our generation, in which there's so many struggles with mental health. And the language that so many use is, I don't feel seen. I feel invisible. I don't think I matter. I don't think anyone would notice if I disappeared. We have an awesome responsibility, all of us in every community, particularly the Zakenim, the leaders of every community, to ensure that no one lives in the margins, that no one is neglected, no one is invisible, no one feels unseen. There are people who do. And I'll tell you, I have a privilege as a rabbi sometimes to interact. I recently did with two such people who both had the same reaction. When I responded to something they shared with me, they said, thank you, I feel seen, I feel noticed. That very language is exactly what the Torah is emphasizing here, the responsibility. So would we suspect? Really, we're going to suspect the Zakenim murdered this corpse? Not directly. But if they led a people in a community that let people feel unseen, they let them walk out unescorted, they let people feel invisible and inconsequential, they don't matter, then a whole community who allows that are responsible for what happens to such a person. Hopefully that will never be us. We'll all take that care. Thank you for coming back. We're on regular time next week. Tomorrow morning we're back on with Tanya and living with Emuna. Have a great day. May we hear Besoros Tovos, Yeshuas, Venechamos.